3 VAs, Ballarat Today.
Tim Watson Munro, he is one of Australia's leading criminal psychologists, and he's spoken to most of the notorious figures that you've heard of. We've mentioned Julian Knight with Hoddle Street. That anniversary is coming up in August, I believe.
22nd anniversary. Yeah, it was 1987.
Yeah, and also the Carlton crew from the Underbelly, so Alphonse Gangitino. He spoke with him, many, many others, and many we don't know of. And that's the thing out in society. There are people out there you just don't know.
I think the weirdest thing about going to court is you see these people who've done horrendous things. They're on trial or whatever. But you look at them and you think, that could be someone's grandmother in the street. You know, that could be anyone. They look so normal. Yeah.
You might be living next to somebody with evil, evil intent. But the reason why we're caught out with him, because he's recently made some comments about some mysterious disappearances of three foreign tourists. They've all disappeared within a matter of 3 months, a small window near beachside locations in New South Wales. You had a couple who were travelling together, and they disappeared from Port Macquarie. Walkers found their belongings on a beach about 6:30 a.m. following morning. They searched the area. They found a van, and inside were travel documents, etc. But the other backpacker was a Belgian backpacker, last seen on May 31 at Cheeky Monkeys nightclub in Byron Bay. So I guess what Tim has come out and said, he said, well, that's no evidence. That's starting to raise some flags, because statistically, it's less and less likely that a group of people disappear in roughly the same area over a short window.
Yeah, the thing with backpackers too is, look, their family, friends, they expect them to be overseas. Yes, they're not going to be in touch for long periods of time, but
makes them easy targets.
Yeah.
Tim, they're red flags that we need to be aware of.
I'm saying this, I'm not trying to be histrionic about it, but it's a huge coincidence that three foreign people, same age range, same demographic in many ways, have disappeared within 300 kilometres of one another in close proximity in time. So I just think it's a bit cute to say they might have all wandered off into the sea and drowned. The analogy I've been using is if you move these disappearances inland to, say, the New England Highway that runs near Armidale, and you had three people who disappeared mysteriously, no bodies found, it would be hauntingly similar to the Belanglo State Forest backpacker murders. So I'm certainly not saying definitively we have a serial killer. I certainly hope I'm wrong, but I think it's important to consider that as a possibility, as a public safety issue, without wishing to be alarmist.
Okay, so it's really red flags that start to pop up that suddenly point your attention to possibilities.
That's it. It's interesting that I've had a few emails since this story broke that other people have gone missing in that area. A couple of have been found, but there was one boy who disappeared. He was from Tasmania. He was last seen in Lennox Head about the 27th of May this year. And as far as I'm aware, he hasn't been found yet. So there's certainly something very odd about these cases.
If these cases are all linked, and it's one or two or maybe a group of people responsible, what sort of personalities are you looking for?
Well, if we are looking at a killer, you're looking at somebody who's able to plan things methodically to get away quickly. I guess in general terms, a person who's bad and is not mad. So this is not the actions of somebody who's out of touch with reality, but somebody who, as is the case with most serial killers, they're able to commit their crimes and escape detection for a long time.
Look, in any city or town around the population, there are potential murderers among us. And I guess with some people, they may have a grudge against a co-worker, might fantasise about doing someone else harm or burying their body in a shallow grave somewhere. How does that line get crossed for a serial killer where all of a sudden it becomes something they actually do?
Most serial killers are sexually motivated, and often there's anger. They're all narcissists. If you look at Ted Bundy, for example, a classic example of the mark, and they find it exciting. They tend to continue offending because they enjoy the notoriety, albeit at a distance, And they enjoy the power of controlling people and seeing the terror and experiencing their fear. And it becomes an addiction for them. If you look at the Golden State Killer, who was recently apprehended through some amazing DNA detective work, he went on for a very long time, killing a lot of people without detection. He was a former policeman.
Wow, so he knew how to, you know, not leave evidence behind and just manoeuvre around what the authorities would be looking for.
That's right, but he didn't count on developments in technology, and particularly DNA analysis. And they caught him in an amazing way that somebody had put up some genetic material on Ancestry.com or something equivalent to that. And they noticed that the DNA on that was similar to DNA of one of the crime scenes. They were then able to narrow the field in terms of potential suspects, as I understand it. And they grabbed one of his Starbucks coffee cups out of a Starbucks facility. And bingo, who's your man? So it's extraordinary, the sort of advances that have occurred through science in enabling people to detect and apprehend these people now.
You kind of lose count when neighbours are interviewed by television crews and they say, oh, they were so quiet, we didn't suspect anything. I think even Ted Bundy got an award for saving somebody from drowning when he was younger.
A charming psychopath, and that's part of their power. They're able to zone in on the weaknesses of people, obtain their trust, and then when they're in a position of being able to control and kill them, they do. We can't talk about the Claremont killer too much because I gather it's sub judice, but there's another example of an alleged person who lived in suburban Perth and apparently was involved with women and kids in terms of hockey teams and so on. So they have a chameleon-like ability to blend into the community.
Julian Knight, the 20th anniversary of Hoddle Street has happened, but look, what do we know about Julian Knight?
Well, Julian was a client of mine. It was actually 1987 that the Hoddle Street massacre occurred. He was an army cadet. He went to Duntroon. He had problems there. He came back to Melbourne. He was awaiting a court-martial, and then one Sunday night in August 1987, he went out onto Hoddle Street and with three high-powered weapons and killed a lot of people. He's another example of a person who was not crazy. He was a person who had obviously a lot of issues, and he was a person who was subjected to considerable vilification and bullying while he was at Duntroon. And no doubt those issues in his life acted to an extent as a trigger for what occurred.
With his continual sort of litigious actions, is he a sort of a guy that feels blameless in himself? Is he never in the wrong, or do they actually say, you know what, yeah, I kind of did stuff up and I lost the plot?
In recent times and years, he's expressed remorse to me. I think with Julian, he's a highly intelligent individual, and he's frustrated. He's locked in jail probably for the rest of his life. He's managed to complete a degree, but the most challenging thing he gets to do each day is sort nuts and bolts when he's given the opportunity. In terms of his litigation, he's attempted in the past to exercise his rights to be treated like other prisoners, which he says never occurs. But certainly in earlier years, there was a degree of denial and obfuscation about what occurred. But people need to bear in mind he's in his 50s now. This happened when he was 19, so a lot of time has passed, and he's had a lot of solitary time to reflect on his actions.
Tim, you've spoken to many of Australia's top killers, I guess you could say, Alphonse Gangitino and Julian Knight, as you say, and there's so many hundreds. How does that affect you when you walk down the street, go past strangers? Have you always got that, thought in the back of your mind that you may be another one?
Well, you know, I think that's a very good question. I certainly have a sixth sense about people. I have a number of children that are adults now, but when they were younger, I was a very protective parent, not a helicopter parent, but I'd want to know who they were going out with, where they were staying. I'd almost interview the parents of their friends to make sure it was safe for them. And they resented it at the time, but now as adults, I say, you know, Dave, we're glad you were protected. We understand where you're coming from. But as I've become older, I've mellowed. I'm less sort of sceptical and cynical about the human condition. I'm basically an optimist. But that said, you never know who you're dealing with.
It's been a pleasure to talk to you again, Tim. You've got a couple of very successful books with The Shrink and The Clink, Dancing with Demons, and they continue to be top of the sales list, don't they?
Yeah, I'm thrilled about it. Thank you. And thanks to all those people who bought the books. I've just signed another contract with Pam McMillan, so book three is on its way. And I must say I'm really enjoying the creative aspect of my life at this time in my life. It's nice to get away to a little bit from the cut and thrust of dealing with hardened criminals and psychopaths. So it's been good for me too.
There we go. That's Tim Watson Munro, and I've got A Shrink in the Clink, the book, and you can't put it down. It's exciting. But isn't he a fascinating person to talk to?
Yeah.
20,000 plus persons of interest he's spoken to, including corporate fraudster Alan Bond, all those Carlton Crew gangsters, and many of Australia's first terrorist convicts as well.
Wouldn't you like to get inside his brain, hey?